eCatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eCatra AI. Welcome to this deep dive. Today we are plunging into one of the most familiar and, let's face it, currently most contested words in political discussion, democracy. We're going to look at it through the incredibly sharp, pragmatic lens of Sir Bernard Quick, drawing on his definitive works, particularly Democracy, Process and Practice.
And this is, you know, it's not just some academic exercise. If you look around the world today, the term democracy is, well, it's dangerously diluted. It's used by regimes that are anything but democratic, while genuine democratic practices, you know, the messy arguments, the endless compromises, are often just taken completely for granted. Or worse, sometimes they're actively dismissed as ineffective.
Right.
So we're seeking to understand Crick's core challenge to us. What makes governance truly democratic? And why should we, the citizens, learn to appreciate its difficult, often complicated reality over some idealized perfect dream? This deep dive is really your shortcut to understanding why democracy isn't a system built for, like, smooth harmony, but a necessary, often frustrating process designed specifically for managing conflict peacefully.
That frames the discussion beautifully.
Okay.
So before we tackle the ideas themselves, let's understand the man behind them a bit more. Sir Bernard Crick, born 1929, passed away in 2008. He was undoubtedly one of Britain's most distinguished political theorists, holding professorships at Sheffield and Birkbeck College, and a PhD from the London School of Economics. I mean, that's a serious academic background.
Absolutely. But what makes his perspective so valuable, I think, is that he wasn't just a theorist locked away in an ivory tower. He was a pragmatic idealist, deeply involved in public life. The key example, maybe, is his role as an advisor for the landmark Crick Report on Citizenship Education. That report fundamentally shaped how civics is actually taught in the UK. So he didn't just write about how democracy should work, he actively shaped how the next generation learned to, you know, practice it.
So his work has this incredible grounding then. It's theory that's been tested by the sheer stubborn reality of policy and, frankly, bureaucracy.
Exactly. And his foundational work, In Defense of Politics, back in 1962, really established his core philosophical stand. It informs everything he wrote about democracy later. He argued that politics is, and this is key, the activity by which differing interests are conciliated through sharing power. It was defending the very act of politics, the negotiation, the inevitable compromise against both utopian visionaries who thought we could transcend disagreement and cynical ideologues who wanted to eliminate the need for argument entirely.
So Crick's authority comes from blending that rigorous theoretical sophistication with a really lived, practical understanding of messy democratic realities. He defends the value of political activity itself against anyone who thinks government should be simple or pure.
Mm-hmm. And that leads directly to the core purpose of his book, Democracy. It's kind of a rescue mission. It aims to rescue the idea of democracy from its uncritical admirers, you know, the ones with wildly unrealistic expectations, and also its detractors who dismiss it because it's slow or maybe frustrating. He provides this clear-eyed assessment of what democracy can, and maybe more importantly, what it cannot achieve. He wrote this for the engaged citizen, for you listening, who needs a clear justification for why self-governance is worth the constant headache, basically.
Okay, and this brings us to the central thesis. It sounds simple, but it's incredibly clarifying. Democracy is fundamentally a process, right? A dynamic system of governance, not some final perfect outcome. He insists its true value isn't that it delivers amazing policy every single time.
Yeah, definitely not.
But that it provides the method, the agreed upon rules, to manage disagreement peacefully and, crucially, allow for the nonviolent transfer of power.
Right, because if we get hung up on the outcome, like, say, a specific tax law or an environmental regulation we don't like, we miss the bigger picture. The real virtue is in the system that allowed that law to be debated, passed, and importantly, potentially reversed next election. The process itself is the safety mechanism. Expecting a perfect outcome from a system run by, let's be honest, fallible humans is just the fastest path to disillusionment.
So to build this argument, Crick takes us on this fascinating intellectual journey, tracing the historical origins. And what's important to him, it seems, is establishing that our modern idea of democracy didn't just spring fully formed from ancient Greece.
Correct. He starts with ancient Athens, which was certainly groundbreaking, no doubt, but it was direct, local, and critically highly exclusive. I mean, excluding women, slaves, resident foreigners from citizenship. It was immediate, maybe even transient. He contrasts this sharply with Roman republicanism.
And why is that contrast so crucial for him?
Because the Roman model introduced these vital concepts of mixed government, where different branches and social classes checked each other's power and the all-important rule of law. The American founders, for instance, were deeply skeptical of the pure Athenian direct model. They genuinely feared it would devolve rapidly into unstable mob rule, as they called it. They saw those Roman Republican principles, institutional checks and balances, as the necessary antidote, really, to popular volatility. This established the idea that democratic health actually requires structural friction.
Okay, let's focus on that friction, because it feels counterintuitive sometimes. Crick details the necessity of institutions and the creation of deliberate delay. We might celebrate elections, sure, but he focuses on the institutional plumbing. Political parties, legislatures, independent courts, civil society. These things seem designed to create resistance.
They are, fundamentally. Crick emphasizes that democratic health requires checks and balances and constant friction. He gives special attention to the role of opposition parties and an independent media. These bodies create necessary delay, and this is where many modern citizens get impatient, all right? Why does Parliament or Congress take so long? Why are there endless appeals in court?
Okay, I have to push back there a little, though.
Yeah.
If friction creates delay, doesn't that often lead to gridlock? Real inefficiency.
Yeah.
Isn't there a point where managed conflict just becomes crippling dysfunction?
That's the central challenge, absolutely. But Crick would argue, I think quite strongly, that inefficiency is often the price of liberty. That friction, the lengthy committee review, the potential for a filibuster, the relentless scrutiny from a critical press, that's the cost of accountability. The alternative to delay is often rapid, unchecked power consolidation, which historically leads towards authoritarianism. The slower the process, theoretically, the more time there is for error correction and public input. Crick really urges us to see the fight and the noise not as flaws, but as the essential safety mechanism built right into the process.
That's a fundamental reframing, isn't it?
Right.
Okay, but if the system is built for friction, how does Crick analyze the contemporary threats that seem to be trying to bypass that friction altogether?
Well, he focuses a lot on internal erosion. First, there is just apathy citizens treating democracy like a spectator sport, taking institutions for granted. If people stop participating, those friction mechanisms, they just stop working effectively, and power inevitably concentrates somewhere else.
And the more active threat, the one that seems to dominate headlines today, is populism.
Exactly. Populism is uniquely dangerous because it actually claims democratic legitimacy. Populist leaders often claim to embody a single, infallible, true will of the people. And they argue that they must bypass the establishment, the courts, the media, the opposition parties, because those institutions are supposedly blocking the people's pure will. This is a direct assault on Crick's whole system of necessary friction and, importantly, minority protection. It's an attempt to turn a diverse, complex political process into a monolithic, simple outcome.
Which really reinforces the idea that democracy is incredibly fragile and needs active defense. And Crick argues that defense begins not necessarily in the legislative chamber, but maybe in the classroom.
Precisely. He dedicates a significant portion of his work to civic education. He stresses that democracy is not some natural state. It is fundamentally a learned behavior. It requires the knowledge, skills, and attitudes for effective political participation. We actually need to teach critical thinking, the ability to debate without dehumanizing the opponent, the art of compromise and collaborative problem solving.
So, in short, if citizens aren't taught how to handle disagreement constructively and how to respect the process itself, they will inevitably seek simple, maybe authoritarian shortcuts when political conflict becomes too intense or frustrating.
Absolutely. It's what ensures that when we disagree, and we will disagree, we use ballots and arguments, not violence.
That gives us such a rich, sort of tough-minded understanding. Okay, let's try and distill this into maybe three core takeaways, linking them back to how we experience politics every day. First, let's reemphasize that point. Democracy is about process, not outcome.
Yeah, the essential message here is really to recalibrate your expectations. Value democracy not because it guarantees perfect solutions, because it won't, but because it guarantees the peaceful framework for correcting bad solutions and resolving disputes. It ensures that if the current path is wrong, you can actually vote to change it without resorting to revolution. That's huge.
So the next time you're genuinely frustrated by, say, a poor policy decision or election result you really hate, try to remember the true value is in the system's resilience. The fact that the defeated side still accepts the outcome and starts preparing to run again, that peaceful handover.
Exactly. The second crucial theme, I think, is the necessity of managed conflict. Crick argues that managed conflict, the argument, the noise, it's essential for democratic health. Authoritarianism, regardless of its ideological flavor, always attempts to eliminate political activity. They try to impose silence, unity through force.
So the noise and the argument in politics are actually a sign of health, not sickness. We should worry when debate disappears, when everything seems perfectly unified and perfectly efficient. Maybe that's the moment to actually be concerned.
Right. And finally, we have to wrestle with the tension between liberty and equality. Democratic politics is really the art of balancing these competing, sometimes contradictory, values. If we emphasize absolute equality, for instance, we lean toward pure majoritarianism, just 51% rule. But if that 51% can vote away the fundamental rights of the 49%, like their freedom of assembly or speech, well, then we've destroyed liberty in the name of equality.
So our ongoing job as citizens, then, is to constantly manage this balance, to demand both majority rule and the non-negotiable protection of minority rights simultaneously. If the process doesn't protect the minority, Crick would say it isn't democracy, it's just tyranny by numbers.
Crick's books are just full of memorable, kind of hard-hitting lines that really stick with you long after you put the book down.
Yeah, let's share a few that truly defined his pragmatic philosophy. First, he reworks that old saying, stating, "The price of democracy is not eternal vigilance, but eternal participation."
That shifts the burden, doesn't it? Vigilance sounds passive, just watching for threats. Participation is active, showing up to meetings, voting, debating, reading the news critically, engaging civilly, even when you disagree. Apathy is that silent poison that just leaves the system undefended.
That's powerful. Here's another on the required conditions for true debate. Democracy is government by discussion, and discussion is only possible among equals.
Yeah, this is such a critical point. If one group is massively unequal in terms of, say, education or economic power or social status, their formal right to vote can feel almost meaningless. Genuine democratic participation requires that citizens have a roughly equal capacity and, you know, voice to actually enter the discussion meaningfully.
And perhaps the quote that best captures his defense of institutions, especially for today: democracy is not about the rule of the majority, but about the protection of minorities within a framework of majority decision making.
That definition feels non-negotiable for him. It means that the rules of the game, the process itself, must fundamentally shield minority rights from the simple will of the majority. If the system fails there, it is not, in his view, a genuine democracy.
Okay, so as we wrap up, how can we apply this sort of pragmatic defense of democracy to our lives right now? What are the practical takeaways?
Well, maybe the most immediate change you can make is internal. Adjust your perspective on political disagreement. Try to view arguments, friction, policy disagreements not just as evidence of dysfunction or chaos, but as the normal and frankly necessary functioning of a healthy, complex system. This might reduce cynicism and encourage you to engage constructively, even with people whose ideas you strongly reject.
And we probably need to become much better consumers of political rhetoric, I think, based on this.
Absolutely. Develop critical literacy. Become instantly skeptical, maybe, of politicians who promise purity or simplicity or claim to speak for a single infallible will of the people. This is often the language of populism and anti-democratic thinking because they are explicitly trying to bypass that complicated, noisy process Crick defends.
Right. And finally, maybe we just need to actively support democratic institutions. The practical application means defending the seemingly unglamorous guardrails, especially when they're unpopular or seem slow, the independent judiciary, a free press, neutral electoral procedures, things like that.
Yeah, these are the essential, maybe sometimes boring but robust defenses against the abuse of power. They're definitely less exciting than a campaign rally, but infinitely more important, arguably, to the survival of the democratic process itself.
You know, what surprised me most about digging back into Crick's work is this insistent demand that we must learn to love democracy for what it actually is. You know, a messy, argumentative, and compromise-filled reality. Because that reality, the noise and the friction, that's the undeniable sound of freedom, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And the lasting insight for me is that democracy is not some historical inevitability or a natural default state. It is a fragile, messy achievement that requires constant attention and learning. But because it is built for fallible humans, like all of us, it crucially allows us to make and, importantly, correct our own errors without resorting to coercion or violence. And that's maybe its greatest, simplest virtue.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accotra Foundation.